Hello and welcome to the Watson Weekend. We're your hosts. I'm Rick Watson.
Hi, it's Jessica Lasuski. Good to see you all. Happy Friday.
I excited to see you again, Jess. This is your weekly dose of medicine with just enough sugar to make it go down well. Your place to go for news and e-commerce, technology, retail, all the things.
All the things. And today, B2B e-commerce. So we're ready
B2B
to dive
commerce.
in. That's right. We are not professionals. We might be getting there slowly. You always will be the judge of that. And you keep us honest, guys. So please watch us live as you are today, but check us out on the replay. If you don't get to see us live, you can catch us on Spotify, Apple, Amazon Music,
YouTube.
YouTube. We're on the tube. Haven't
Yes.
hit the talk yet. We're going to find our way there. We just have to shorten the show a little bit into like micro bites.
Yeah. That's great. Today we're going to have a special B2B commerce episode. We recently did some work and found from the International Trade Association, which is a US or global trade organization, and that B2B commerce is now 36 trillion in sales, which is a tremendous number. We have a great guest, Jack Freeman from Peakspan Capital, who's a partner there. The company's been investing, was founded in 2015, and has been investing in growth stage B2B companies. So we're excited to really hone in on B2B commerce, what's been exploding there. And so with that, I think we have a great sponsor for the show today,
We
Jess.
do. Yeah, we are so grateful that Mirakl helps bring this show to you every week. And with Mirakl, traditional commerce is just code for not growing. It's time to do better than the status quo. You can join 450 plus retailers who are scaling six times faster with AI automation, a platform built for what's next, marketplace dropship, retail media at enterprise grade scale. It's time to accelerate with Mirakl, and we appreciate them bringing the show to you. So thanks, and you should go check them out.
Awesome. And with that, we're going to get into the headline hangover, which is sponsored by Passport, your partner for global growth. Our rundown of the news starts with Amazon versus Shopify. Both have reported order earnings recently, and there was a news report out from Colin Sebastian, which is a longtime analyst from Baird, who said that Amazon is considering re-entering the e-commerce platform market with a new, of course, agentic solution. If there's agent not in there, it's not going to happen. And
It's not
these
gonna ha It's
days,
not even real. It's fake
it's
news.
not real. Amazon is also saying that Saks is now a big luxury partner. What is Saks anymore? Is it a Ponzi debt scheme? Is it a retailer? Is it grow? Is it a store? Is it online?
Think it has lots of nostalgia. It also probably has a customer base that's aging out. So I think that yeah, I it Saks was plastered all over the Amazon home screen. I saw it many, many times. They're very proud of this partnership. And I think has Amazon won the luxury battle with this one? Maybe.
Did you see any big brands that actually are on in Saks and also in the Amazon app? Did you count them?
That's not the point, Rick. The point is they have sex, okay? It's not the point about the quality of the brands. It's fine. It's totally fine.
Right, everything is fine here, just
Everything
fine.
is fine here. There's nothing to see. They have sex. I don't really don't understand what the issue is. They have one luxury. Let's shut it down. And yeah, so what else happened in this Amazon Shopify battle here?
I mean, I think they are there's not a lot else happening here, really. I mean, the story is about Amazon entering the e-com platform market. I don't predict that this is going to amount to much because it's not just Amazon is saying like, oh, it's going to be very easy to create a new storefront. Like, well,
Sure.
you can create a new storefront anywhere. You can go to Claude, you can go to ChatGPT, and we'll create you a storefront literally. Why do you need to go to Amazon and do it? And by the way, how are you going to run the store? And so you're still going to need connections to all the marketplaces. You're still going to need like all the apps that are in,
Yeah.
the Shopify App Store. So,
Do you get by with Prime? Do
buy
you
with Prime. Buy with Prime comes free.
Okay.
Buy a friend comes free.
Sold. And Amazon payments integration. You got
That's great. All right.
Yeah. And maybe I get a discount on, you know, retail media on Amazon. Probably not. You probably get an upcharge.
Yeah. So. Speaking of someone who's hitting the skids, Temu.
Temu. Yeah. We hit a full on reverse, like no other. Yeah. It was like totally. Yep. So if you remember a couple weeks ago, they were announcing some pretty significant price hikes because A, tariffs, B, de minimis gone, like they can't participate. Ouch. Yeah, whole business model. There was also, if you were not, did not see this, I don't know where you were. Your head was like in the sand, ostrich style. But there was this whole chart that went around about just how much they had pulled off of Google Shopping and their Google spend going way down. No more Super Bowl ad spending or, you know, in this case, the Stanley Cup spends. Not happening. So, but now they're basically saying, hey, guys, hold on. We're not going to do these price hikes. We've got a better strategy instead, which is we're going to rely on our U.S. seller base. You know, they have roughly about 300,000 sellers. Rick and I were talking a little bit before the show. It sounds like, you know, they're saying 60% of their GMV is like in the U.S. is coming from U.S. sellers. I don't know. That doesn't really pass the sniff test for me. We'll see. And I saw back in, you know, before the holidays was that it was like less than 1% of their sellers were supposedly U.S. merchants. So that account team has been hitting the pavement and recruiting real hard. They've got more sellers. They're going to rely on those. And that's what's going to keep the prices low. So you think that's legit or
I think nobody is shopping like a billionaire anymore. That's the problem that Temu has, which was their
David Beckham, remember he wanted to get those like $5 Puma
so bad
joggers
so bad.
Yeah. So
anyway, I think it's probably 95% U.S. sellers because they shut all the Chinese ones down. So I don't think they have any trouble hitting their number. The problem is the growth. If they shut off advertising, you know, their app store downloads are there. And so we're going to have to see what happens here as far as next. But speaking of it, going back to the Shopify story, the next story is like Shopify reported earnings. They're growing. They are not afraid of tariffs, just like the Ghostbusters and Bill Murray were not afraid of any ghosts. Mm-mm. Ain't scared. Very bullish on earnings call, of which Harley, I'm trying to match his speed here. He was on 2x speed, I think, on the earnings call, like running through everything that he had to say.
He had a 5-hour energy before that.
He had. So they're in the mid-20s from a growth point of view, operating income growing, mid-teens. Europe. GMV growing 36% year over year, which is a huge number and frankly surprising for a U.S. Mm-hmm. company growing so much in Europe. And like, I think one of the things that I pointed out on LinkedIn this week is just like, it's just such a failure of the like, the native European platforms mm-hmm. and all the platforms that had, frankly, a head start mm-hmm. in this market. So it seems to me that Shopify is investing in its go-to-market teams there. And is taking share. There's not a lot of kind of like downsides. I would say Shop Pay off platform got a few mentions with Tapestry, Lilly Pulitzer, you know, some other brands like this. It seems to me like the biggest brands that Shopify mentioned were actually Shop Pay off platform. So like someone who wanted Shop Pay, similar to the fact that they have PayPal or something like that, they're also in the checkout. Right. It wasn't huge brands replatforming to Shopify, although they had some medium and large size brands that they mentioned. Vuori, BarkBox was one, but those aren't
Mr.
like
Beast mentioned?
Mr. Beast was missing in action. We didn't hear. I think he's in a compound somewhere in North Carolina.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shopify, they also didn't really mention tariffs much and didn't talk about this as a headwind. And you mentioned it's really an economic problem, not a Shopify problem. Why do you think this wasn't like part of the narrative?
It's not. First of all, Shopify tends to say that their business is diversified. Although I think while they're diversified a category, I expect quite a number of their merchants are, you know, sourcing from China, and if 156% tariff remains, then I think Shopify is as exposed as anyone else in the retail market. you know, as you mentioned with my commentary before, the fact that Shopify is exposed is, to me, a good thing, because otherwise, where are they sourcing from? Right. Everyone is sourcing from China, really. I mean, it would just mean they had a lot of, like, not very smart merchants if they were sourcing from a lot of other places. So I do think they're underplaying their exposure somewhat, but I do think at this point, Shopify is such a big percentage of e-com. I think last number I heard was like 5 to 10% in the US from a GMV point of view. That continues to grow. So it was a good quarter for them. They definitely swept under the rug any tariff concerns. And we'll see how that plays out.
What's the benefit? Because anyone that's mentioned tariffs as part of why they can't share guidance or they've got growing concerns has been, you know, butchered then the next day. So, like, what was actually the benefit of doing it? Everyone knows it's there. So I get it. All right, bring us home. There's another kind of interesting thing in the OpenAI space. Sounds like they're ready to monetize, make some cash.
Yeah, OpenAI, I mean, has stumbled a number of times in the last few years, but they're still like one of the fastest growing SaaS apps to 1 billion users. And Fidji Simo, the Instacart CEO, has stepped down for her role and in the next few months will join OpenAI as their head of business application and product, which is kind of like a sideways down move. But if you think about how huge and the potential of OpenAI, it's actually quite a big step up. I mean, it's almost like when someone goes from the CEO of a startup to Amazon, that like a lot of times they come, even if like a decent sized company, they come in as a director when there's like four or five levels above them. I think this is the kind of the situation with OpenAI. I think this actually says a couple of things. One, Fidji Simo did a great job at Instacart. Like the stock has been performing well. They've been expanding their service. She really invested a lot in AI and helping people with ingredients and recipes in the app. So the app has improved supply. So, you know, there was a big questions when she came in, like, would Instacart just be a pandemic hero or could it keep growing after? And I think she's proven that. So this is, to me, a feather in her cap. Sure. I also think it's like the cavalry running to the defense of Sam Altman. Like, the guy needs some help. Like, he cannot be the only guy out there talking about OpenAI. I think it's a huge mistake. So she also has a bird's eye view into the company. She was previously on the OpenAI board, although she's also on the board, you know, will continue to be chairman of the board of Instacart and on the board at Shopify. So she has a pretty wide purview of Silicon Valley. So I do think this is a good move for OpenAI. And so we'll see what happens next there.
Yeah, for sure. I think it, you know, what stood out to me in the summary was like, you know, she's focused product management. She's focused on monetization at Instacart. Like, I would think she's coming in to figure out, all right, where do we play? How do we monetize? How do we aggregate and get more organized than we are today? So I'm excited to see what she does.
Yeah, I mean, OpenAI is definitely at an inflection point where they have the most usage of the public facing LLMs out there right now. And so they need packaging, not only in sort of how the users consume the product, but how they plug into all these ecosystem partners kind of across the world. And I think her Meta experience will help with that. Instacart probably less, although, you know, they plug into a lot of suppliers and retailers too. So
yeah. All right. Well, we have got to get to our guest. Jack's been waiting for a bit. Do you mind breaking down the intro for us, Rick, before we bring Jack on?
Yeah, we are excited to welcome Jack Freeman, who is a partner at a company called Peakspan Capital, which is a venture capital firm founded in 2015, dedicated to growth stage B2B, fintech, and supply chain. Prior to joining Peakspan, Jack worked for Stackpop, an early stage startup, helped to build out a SaaS spend management platform. And previously, after that startup, Jack joined Macquarie Capital, who he spent 3 years executing software M&A. And so now he looks over their portfolio, which is billions under management, and you know, invests in quite a number of software companies in a year. So we're excited to have Jack come on. They have been investing in B2B commerce for a long time. And so I think our listeners you know, will be wise to pay attention to what's happening there, not only in the sort of the software provider space, but also what it means for distributors and manufacturers in the space. So with all that, welcome Jack Freeman to our show.
Thank you, Rick. Hi, Jess. Hey, Rick. Thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, we can't wait to dive in. I think especially because B2B is one of those for years, maybe even decades. It's like, this is going to be the next biggest thing. It's on the horizon. And now it feels like we've hit this point that it's not a temporary wave. There is real momentum. And so before we just dive right in, can you set the tone and kind of what's the landscape and what was like, what has been kind of that tipping point maybe that makes B2B feel more sustainable from an e-commerce growth perspective?
It's an excellent place to start. And Rick noted that, you know, I've been investing in B2B commerce for a decade. That is partially true. And I think the reason it's partially true is actually a really good place to start, which is we've been deeply looking at B2B commerce for a decade and speaking with lots and lots and lots of software companies. We've arguably made a handful. I'll talk about a few of them today if we get there. But it's been a very, very slow grind. And I think there's been a couple different factors over the years that have led to this. And you know, where I started my journey was actually procurement. And I always say, you know, procurement and B2B e-commerce are like cousins. They're very, very close.
They hang out.
They hang out, yeah. And then you also have, you know, if you look at the stats behind like consumer payments and B2B payments, like, you know, massive volumes. The digitization of B2B payments as well has also been like a trend that's been ongoing for a decade. Along that time span, as you know, you've been talking about, like, Shopify's been doing its thing, Amazon's been doing its thing. You know, we've been growing the commerce, the B2C commerce world quite a bit. I think along that timeline, we've seen, you know, companies like BigCommerce, like, yeah, try to stake their claim in B2B. Shopify, we recently did a little analysis on like how often they have mentioned B2B in their things, and like they've mentioned it over the years for sure, but now they're really trying to put their you know, stake in the sand and mentioned a million times. And then from the, you know, Series A investor perspective, companies have been founded and have been trying to scale B2B commerce solutions for that entire 10 years. And I, like I said, it's been a grind. It's been painfully slow. There's been some, you know, platforms that have risen, not to the Shopify BigCommerce level, but like, you know, medium scale. And then there's been point solutions that have tried, but I think there's been a lot of headwinds, a lot of friction, a lot of adoption that we have to overcome together as a community. And we'll get into it, but I think there's some things here and now that get me really excited moving forward, but it's still like a not an overnight success in B2B commerce, despite it kind of seeming that way.
Yeah.
I mean, you wrote a report as part of Peakspan about kind of the rise in B2B commerce, why it matters, why it's happening now. A few stats that jumped out to me as to why this is happening now is that 70% of B2B buyers are actually millennials, and 83% of buyers now prefer managing orders online, which clearly B2B is a, you know, a dusty industry, you know, industry at best. I don't even like the term B2B just because you have so many just specialized industries. It's just like they have sales and service. It's sales and service. I mean, that's what it is, right? I mean, and as you said, procurement is probably the other leg of it. And so that's what really B2B commerce means, you know, to these organizations.
I think you're right. And, you know, when I have these discussions, I always like to call out an important distinction when we talk about B2B that I can't take credit for it. I think it was someone at Shopify that gave me this analogy, which is you have two types of B2B. One is brands that sell to consumers that can do it direct that can also sell via B2B channels. And then separately, there are B2B products like, you know, HVAC equipment that is very complex and it's a B2B sale and it's customized, configured. There's a spec sheet that's like 10,000 pages long. That's a version of B2B that I think is really interesting. And then there's also like the, you know, Shopify brands that now can sell B2B.
Yeah.
Yeah. And well, we had Aztrak on a couple of weeks ago, and I mean, they're selling this massive equipment, right, to all over the world. So it is interesting to see even these like industrial B2B markets open up and start to embrace e-commerce. And do you think it's also because we are now starting to hit a buyer base that is more digitally native, right? They've grown up in e-commerce to a certain extent. And so it's feeling like, hey, this is just a more natural adoption and those barriers aren't there where people needed to like talk on the phone or, you know, handshake a deal in person. Like, are we kind of beyond that point and people are comfortable just shop till you drop but in a B2B way?
I think you're spot on. And back to something Rick said as well, where he hates like the B2B e-commerce, you know, phrase, mm-hmm. and that's just sales. When we did our research, we like reached out to dozens of executives at like manufacturers, wholesalers, and distributors who were responsible for doing sales. And it dawned on me early on that like, an e-commerce platform is like one leg of the stool. The e-commerce value chain is actually very sales rep driven. So like historically, to your point, it's like, well, B2B commerce is like, oh, we have 100 field sales reps that are golfing and going to dinners and they're selling big pieces of equipment. And we're now in that, you know, the son or daughter of the distributor is now, you know, taking over and they grew up with technology and they're like, well, how do I use AI and how do I use software to automate the business? And then you get into the situations where it's like, well, if we now can have a platform that houses all of our products and our customers can, you know, click the link and go on and see their custom pricing and buy their stuff on the website. Well, do I need the 100 sales reps anymore? Or can I have those 100 sales reps do even more because they're not bogged down in the, you know, taking
minutia. Yeah. Like the quote process and all of those things. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's really like a go for it, Rick. Sorry.
No, it's interesting. You mentioned some of the platforms and a lot of like small and medium growing platforms. And then you kind of have like the big ones that have been around for a while. Historically, Magento has been customized to support B2B. And so that kind of rolled into Adobe. Salesforce has a native platform for B2B for, you know, quite a number of larger program companies. And you can understand why CRM is such a big part of B2B. And there are zero B2B sales organizations that aren't using Salesforce or some customized version of a CRM. So Sales and Service Cloud, I think, has a big advantage. You mentioned Shopify, which, like, look, from my point of view, two years ago could barely spell B2B, at least from when you get to the distributor and manufacturer point of view and like these complex sales. Do you feel that their new focus on this market is having an impact, and what impact is it?
Great question. And I want to come back to the legacy B2B e-commerce platform comment as well, because I think that's super interesting. I'm bullish on what Shopify can do for the ecosystem. And I touched on it earlier, which is not that they're necessarily like doing stuff that only they know how to do. I think other companies like Oro is a decent example that, you know, were like independent earlier on in the journey and like built. And I think they skew more towards they can handle all the complex products and they've really built it like specific to B2B. It's not that they're doing things that Oro is not, it's that they're Shopify and everyone, their distribution, their reach, their brand, they're global, they're talking about it on earnings calls, and that will help lift all boats. I don't think because Shopify, you know, will lead the charge, doesn't mean they will fully win the space. Maybe someone could draw those dots, but I think they will help the whole ecosystem just due to like notoriety and the brands they serve. And this is back to that other type of B2B, like the brands they serve when they're sold on the B2B modules and functionality, they might, Shopify might help pull brands into the world of like, oh, I can have a D2C storefront. I can also work my B2B channels on Shopify, and that might just bring more people into the ecosystem. And then those companies might buy other point solutions that are in the Shopify app store, and that will help those applications. And then I think digital, like more modern platforms like Oura that I mentioned, like will benefit from that, just shift more to like modern cloud-based B2B platforms. And then on the legacy comment, I think that's a really interesting conundrum, because I think a lot of these B2B or just like manufacturers, wholesalers, distributors, mm-hmm. they've spent so much on these
yeah.
solutions, and yeah. they are tied with their field sales and CRM yeah. like deployments. But then they ask that same provider, like, hey, can you build me a B2B storefront? And literally it feels like they've built them a custom B2B storefront yeah. is what I've been hearing.
Yeah.
So maybe at some point they flip over to like a more modern Shopify or otherwise solution. But this is back to my first comment, which is that just takes so much time. So like, when will these custom Magento B2B storefronts move on?
Yeah, it takes a while. People don't like to re-platform unless it's like something is burning on fire, or, you know, you get private equity involved and now they're trying to roll up 5 or 6 or 10 sometimes new companies, and you're like, we need something that scales. Yeah, yeah. That scales a little better, because we don't want 10 platforms. Mm-hmm. Even if that journey takes a decade, at least you're on the journey rather than not having a plan at all.
Yeah. Well, and also there's you mentioned some of this too, the other aspects of B2B, you know, there's definitely the platform piece, but now you've got to work through supply chain and pricing and catalog. Do you feel like there have been big wins in changes and shifts in how that gets handled with modernization of technology? Or do you think people are just better at solving those problems because they're now interested in solving those problems today?
Yeah, it's a great point. I've seen, if I'm answering the question correctly, I've seen startups definitely tackling the problems in the right way. You have very smart founders who come from like e-commerce and B2B that are solving those problems with great solutions. The issue that I see is more, I guess, like the market readiness and adoption curve, and like the fact that like a lot of the buyers, I mean, first of all, back to the two different camps, selling into distributors and manufacturers and wholesalers is not fun. It's hard. Like, I see great technology and they grow okay, but not the same way that you can grow. Like, we also have investments we can talk about in our portfolio that are mm-hmm. D2C e-commerce. Mm-hmm. Those are just easier to grow. You have brands that like want to grow and they buy e-commerce sales and marketing solutions to help them grow. And there's millions of merchants out there that are just adopting technology.
Yeah.
Distributors, I forget the numbers. There's like a couple hundred thousand, if not like high couple hundred thousand, I think, in the US. Like, it's not a bad market. It's why I look at it very extensively. Mm-hmm. But they're slower to adopt. They're maybe still undergoing that generational shift. Yeah. They're not like wired to, you know, I saw a customer communication platform for distributors that raised like this past year. Genius idea from my perspective, and they're doing well, but I think they're pulling that market to adopt. Yeah. Versus like, like Klaviyo or someone like that's more of a, let's all jump on the ship, versus like in the distributor world, it's like, let me convince you why you need like a pricing algorithm to help with your sales.
So if you're one of these platforms or technologies that's solving a problem, whether it's communication, catalog, supply chain, is a strategy that you've seen work well to go in and hit an industry, get one of the top players to get on board, and will others follow? Or do they have to kind of break out to lots of different industries to just place bets in many different areas?
That's a great question. I think when it comes to distributors, I think that stands on its own. I think like the distributor world, like you can, you know, come from the distributor world and sell tech to distributors, and it's generally the same. Like maybe the food and bev distributors are a little different, and like, but I kind of clump them together. And then from like a manufacturer perspective, absolutely. You know, we look at food and bev quite extensively. Mm-hmm. I think, B2B food and bev solutions, like to your point, if you're just if you're just doing food and bev, like you're going to be the best at it versus trying to do kind of other types. And then, you know, other product categories outside of food and bev, for us could be like, industrial supply. So, you know, dispatch or last mile delivery marketplace. We serve like flooring, roofing, HVAC, paint, these types of industries, and they have similar end customers, similar delivery demands, similar ways that they sell. And so that type of focus, we've definitely, to your point, have seen companies thrive in verticalization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, like have a venture capitalist focused on B2B technology because each of these verticals is very different. Usually you see VCs focused on these, like, you know, have to dent the universe style opportunities, you know, for it to amount to an exit that you care about. Obviously investing early stage, you probably don't need to get to $1 billion. What do you think is the moat in this market? Like, how do you get to stickiness versus just something that'll be replaced by one of these platforms as you, like, I guess specifically talking about the application side of the world, like your chat example?
Yeah. Great questions. So I actually think for some of the reasons that you started talking about, like early in the first segment of the call, massive market, like bigger market than D2C. There are a lot of constituents to sell into. Probably the end of customers is like a little bit bigger in consumer because you have like these very small upstart brands. But actually, you know, pros and cons on the B2B side, there's not as many small upstart brands, but the that have been in B2B on average have been in existence for way longer, like 5 to 50 years. So long-standing companies, very stable, large market based on volume of revenue, which obviously drives a company's ability to adopt technology. Slow adoption curve for sure. That's the con, but very sticky. Like, and then along with stickiness is the competitive density. So like that customer communication platform for distributors that I mentioned, they're one of one. On the D2C e-commerce side, if I was to pluck out the one category that we invested in, our competitive landscape in our investment memo is like 2 pages long, because for every category on Shopify, if you just go up on App Store, there's 50 options.
Right.
So the B2B opportunity is like, and this is actually exactly what you scratched on, and is why not a lot of true like venture capitalists are going to pummel this category. It's because you can't like invest a ton of money and then hope, you know, you get that Shopify story where it goes public in 5 years. It's just not going to move that fast, but it is less competitively dense, a massive market, very low penetration. And so those market dynamics are very attractive to an investor like Peakspan, who can maybe be patient and who does not need to see an IPO to be successful.
Yeah.
I wanted to drill into founders a minute, because obviously as an investor, look, you care about results, but you also care about the background of the founder super as well. It's, you know, I think there are kind of two tacks. One is like you pick someone who's scaled and built software companies and just understand how software companies run. But then in a market like this, do you look for someone or a team, for instance, maybe someone on the team that understands like a few of these sectors, I don't know, like industrial or scientific, or, and it has the connection so that they can scale their go to market quickly? Like how do you find that balance, and what are you looking for when you make investments?
Yeah, great question. I'll take a slight step back and talk about my experience in supply chain, which is, unfortunately, you have way more founders that come from the supply chain world that get the idea because they live in supply chain and they have no idea how to scale a software company. Mm-hmm. You occasionally have like a, you know, Stanford grad, smart, or X other category founder who is successful, decide I'm going to jump into the supply chain world and like start a company. That's more rare. And like, obviously people could throw stones at that type of profile where it's like, oh, well, you don't know the market. that's rare. But the first camp is what I see most, which is like great ideas, amazing technology, really struggle with commercializing and going to market on the blockchain side. Mm-hmm. And so what do we look for? I think it has to be a little both. And I even might lean a little bit towards if it's a great, you know, product, great idea, product market fit is established. Someone who's going to be better at scaling, better, more competent with go to market. And it depends also on like the customer size, but in supply chain, the thing that the fallacy that I often see is that you start the company and then you just go immediately after really big organizations, for CVs, and they're like, "You're a small company. I don't want to talk to you." Like we're going
to
go
prove to me.
We're going to go with that. This is why like Manhattan and Descartes and SAP and Oracle, like it's why they're still so dominant in supply chain is because like you don't get fired for going with them and you're not going with the small startup. And so it's a tall order to start a supply chain company and go after the enterprise right away. And so we look for solutions that maybe are not trying to jump to the enterprise and are starting more in the mid-market where there's a larger end of targets and where they definitely like know the space and the pain points, but they know how to scale. They know how to add more and more logos in that mid-market.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you've done investments in the US and around the world, the UK as well. Are there markets that are more interesting to you right now at like a country level, region level? What are you seeing?
Yeah. In supply chain e-commerce, we're sticking to the US and Europe. It's a lot, but like those are the two core geographies that we stick to. And I think in Europe, like for most categories, I shouldn't say most, but for the right categories, you're able to serve like a multi-country span, which is important for monetizing. Like if people don't know, and I didn't like really look at the data until like halfway through my career, the reason there's so many software companies in the US and why everyone loves the US is because like if you actually look at the market size of like every country, it trumps most. You have to stitch together 5 to 10 countries to like have reasonable TAM. Mm-hmm. And so for digital technologies that like exist at the cart or the website or the procurement, and yes, like love Europe. Sometimes it's less densely competitive, still a lot of business buyers, a lot of manufacturers. Mm-hmm. On the ground, like that last mile logistics company Dispatch in the US.
Yep.
We are very careful in different countries on more physical world infrastructure because unless it spans multiple countries, you could be a bit constrained. And if you're trying to do last mile delivery in Norway and Sweden, like maybe your network doesn't work across borders. Yeah. That's how we think about it. At least is like, if it's digital, great. If it's physical, be a little careful. And then also just make sure you are honest about the market size.
Yep.
Yeah, I think another constraining factor, Vinny and I recently reduced some reports that we did in conjunction with Shopware, where we looked at, one of them was particularly about regulated industries and B2B. And so things like alcohol, firearms, CBD, med tech, all these are sort of big B2B commerce categories because you have these sort of multi-level selling and distributor relationships, either because of the government or you know, how complex the sales process is. Does your research and firm intersect with some of these regulated industries? And do you see that as important for your founders and companies to understand?
Yeah. As you were going through that, the comment or the observation that came to my mind was, that those industries are actually better for software. So if we're talking about it from like an investor perspective, and you can actually see this in like studying private equity transactions, like who is private equity interested in? That's not that they're the smartest and all be all, but like, you know, it's an interesting data point if like multiple private equity firms invest in supply chain risk management, like Everstream, Exiger, those types of companies, like that space got completely acquired by PE. And then you also have like, whether it's like office of the CFO or supply chain play, technologies that touch regulated industries that manage the data. I think those are obviously just very big TAMs, like pharmaceuticals, like drug manufacturing, food.
Yeah.
They're very big and there's a lot of complexity and there's like cost to being wrong and not being And that's like a great use case for software. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question, Rick, but as you were going through that, I was like, yes, regulated industries, very hot in the software world. People actively target them. I'll actually share our company Symphony in the procure tech space. We do very well with regulated industries, the acronym we use, but like chemical and drug and food, these types of verticals, like when you're working with suppliers and doing sourcing, the data integrity and supplier management flows are like just a little bit more higher stakes. And so that just makes it a better like software buy for us.
Yeah. It's super interesting because people want that peace of mind, right? So they might be willing to pay for that if the software company can get it right, do it well, and have those proof points. So when you think about going back to where we all started, which was B2B's got this transitional moment. There is a market to win here. It's huge. In the platform space, there's lots of people duking it out and like lots of people want to emerge as the key player. Who do you think's most well positioned, and does it matter at a vertical level, or is there one like holistically that's you're like, yep, they pretty much got it in the bag from a market share perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think this data exists. I think we know the platforms that are duking it out. There's some good lists out there. I don't know if we know the revenue.
Yeah, there's like 70, right?
Exactly. And we don't have the revenue handy, but like I know offhand like where some of them kind of sit. And like I'd first start by saying like the fragmentation is crazy. No one's close to owning it. And that combined with how slowly it moves, and just like even for Shopify to get to where it was on the consumer side, it's kind of crazy. Like other than that, it's very fragmented and it's global and there's different sizes and verticals. So like I would not bet on anyone dominating it. I'd bet on Shopify initially maybe moving the needle and maybe if they're selling into their installed base.
Yeah.
And hoping like their D2C merchants open up B2B channels, like that feels
translatable. But
otherwise, I think you both are spot on with your questions. Like there'll be vertically oriented solutions that do well in certain categories. Maybe there's some regional, you know, that are stronger. I like to look at things by ICP. So if there's just like a wholesaler or distributor focused solution, like anything that's distributed is tech, I'm looking at. And I think there's some room for leaders to emerge just focused on distributors. But I would not bet on anyone like being the clear form market share leader anytime soon.
Yeah. But that's what I think where it's interesting for whether it's Peakspan or PE or like that's where you probably start to see industries roll up, right? And kind of combine either these solutions or technologies to serve either multiple industries. I wonder, do you see that space like similar to how the B2C world, you know, different PE firms were buying into different commerce companies or retailers and trying to roll them up and like get economies of scale. Do you see that as like another wave in the like investment world?
Yeah, I think it depends on the vertical. I don't know if I've heard of a quote unquote B2B roll up, but I think you're more like the merchant, like the same way that you would buy a lot of merchants and then like cut costs and, you know, logistics, like I would expect certain categories of B2B. Like I don't know if this is a good example, but I think it's Carrier or one of those big HVAC holding companies, they've like bought a lot of other HVAC
manufacturers,
and they have different brands and like
qualities
in there. So it will depend on the vertical, but like, yes, some of those, food and bev, which you can argue, I don't know if we're thinking that's like consumer or B2B because you're distributing through retailers and supermarkets, but like on the food and bev side, you definitely see like brands get aggregated quite a bit. So depends on the category. On the tech side, I don't think I've seen a B2B technology, like B2B commerce technology roll up.
Like start to roll up.
But
well, like this Salesforce demand, like the demand where, you know, kind of thinking about all those different solutions coming together. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've seen recently is like, even players I weren't necessarily, you don't think is directly in the space, like a ServiceNow just acquired. You probably saw the same thing, Logic AI, which was like one of the leading CPQ solutions out there. You would think that one of the bigger platforms would have done that, but does this put, it kind of highlights the fragmentation of the space and how much service is a, like, especially with sort of like, you know, PE thinks about sort of the razor and the blades model. Service is the big opportunity. It's not the, right. initial sale. And so a company like ServiceNow that no one really thinks about so much as big in B2B commerce per se, they could be a huge player.
No, you're spot on. I love how you keep going back to this, because I think this is like the point, which is B2B commerce. If we're talking about like manufacturer, wholesaler, distributor moving and selling goods B2B, like you think about the landscape of who could win, who can roll it up, who's going to dominate. The players are the incumbents that we talked about, like Salesforce, etc. But then also maybe about something you said, Jess, it's been a sales rep driven thing, and so like we actually look at like our sales tech and martech portfolio, like Cordial is an email marketing platform. They have B2B in there too. Sales and marketing tech for a long time like has served D2C and B2B. And so the ICP that or the situation everyone's trying to unlock, like it's being served by existing incumbents across sales, marketing, and then to Rick's point, service. And then there's on platform piece, the customer communication piece, but these categories in the B2B technology, not B2B commerce, but B2B technology landscape, all these companies have already been being sold to. And so it's actually a really good point. Like, am I being too, I don't know, esoteric with like, there's some like B2B commerce platform giant that's going to emerge, or will companies just, you know, use ServiceNow, use Salesforce, use Shopify for their platform and stitch together their own tech stack? Like maybe that is just where we're going.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword sometimes, because I mean, I've been in a couple of B2B RFPs recently for distributors and manufacturers in that kind of sector of the world. And some of them turn into like RFIs where there's like 7 or 10 companies, platforms they want to talk to. And these platforms, there's so much sameness, like all of these things, like 80% of everything looks exactly the same. So the game is at the margins. And then if you think about the big incumbents, like a Salesforce, it's sort of good and bad their position, because their commerce solution is so embedded into their CRM solution. But that's good and bad. And meaning that like, if you're a PE rolling up 10 companies, are you going to put all of those companies on Salesforce? And if the answer is no, can you even buy Salesforce commerce? Or do you need something simpler, nimbler, one of these more specialized places like an Oro or Shopware or BigCommerce or, you know, these other solutions?
Yeah. It's fascinating. Well, I won't name the names because I don't want these people getting like lots of outreach, but what I did was I studied Shopify's B2B e-commerce case studies. If you just go on like their website, they have like studies, and talk to those organizations to see like what, you know, what their situation was. And they're like obviously the early adopters and the ones that like Shopify's, you know, promoting. But it is interesting to hear their stories. They're big, complex organizations, and like, you know, I always like to, in B2B software, like take a step back.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what is happening, especially in these like early adopter markets, is there's some person at one of these old companies.
You're totally right.
Is like kind of a, kind of curse on this,
yeah,
kind of a badass. Like they're edgy. They're like, I want to rip down the legacy technology and I want to implement something new. And like the amount of people out there, I wish there was more as a B2B technology investor,
but yeah,
like usually there's not those people, which is why you stick with your Magento custom thing for 20 years.
Yeah.
So I always like to think like you have to get that person to champion the big digital transformation project and stick around at the company.
Right.
You're going to have to see your new Shopify implementation nice and shiny, you know, come out the other side.
Which is hard because these are big, slow companies that don't necessarily attract all the biggest tech innovators,
exactly.
that you see in some of the, like the sexier companies. I think this is a good point for us to wrap. I would love for you to look at, you know, this next year, obviously being a VC on our show, there are a lot of founders in the audience and tech companies or also brands that use some of these tech companies. You're looking at the market as much as anyone else. The market has been, you know, kind of like pre-COVID, you know, boom times. COVID is like really great for commerce, but then obviously supply chain uncertainty coming, we're sort of like past the post-COVID tail really at this point. And we're in a little bit of a new era. How do you see that from an investment point of view? What are you advising your founders?
Can I go on a quick tangent?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is based on two conversations I had. One was a tariffs like roundtable that we posted yesterday, which is super interesting. And it was I posed a question that was like very negative, where I said, okay, like I'm a huge e-commerce bull. I think it's going, you know, I want to invest in it forever. Like, I think it's going places. It's going to go up and to the right. There'll be little dips, but we're definitely going to continue to see it grow. But like, what if like, you know, global trade negotiations go as such where there's just no more like China manufacturing shipped to the U.S. sell cheap. Don't you think that like 20% of the small merchants whose business models relied on that supply chain will just fold? Like, and do you think like, despite me being bull on e-commerce, do you think we might go back more to retail because people won't there won't be an abundance of products that we're selecting, hyper personalization where I can pick between 25 different running shoes? Like maybe I just have to go to the running shoe store and pick one of three. Like, are we heading back in that direction?
Trump told us we only needed three dolls.
That's exactly right. And all of these supply chain execs say uniformly no. And they're like the chief supply chain officer at like Mattel, global VP at DHL, like people who are in it, all were very bullish that we will take these headwinds, figure them out, adapt, and keep going. And it will be a combination of like retooling, re-strategizing, from supply chains, from merchants, and then, you know, consumers might bear a little bit more of the cost, merchants might bear some cost, like, but the ecosystem, they were very adamant that it will continue to propel e-commerce, and it will just force us to adapt. And so that
consumerism, you know, will still win. People want their stuff.
That was the punchline, and I'm all for it. And so like, I'm excited to see how we all adapt from like investment, merchant, supply chain, distributor, wholesaler. These pressures will just make us, I think, stronger and more resilient, and the growth will continue. To your point, you know, commerce will prevail.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great place to end. Also a great plug for you, adapt or die, right? So we are in the adapting business. And
I think that's a Kaplan trademark. I don't know if you have to pay him royalties for that, Jess.
We might have to. He's going to give me later next week. I'm sure I'll hear about that. But thank you so much, Jack, for being on the show. It's been really an engaging conversation. I learned a ton. I'm sure our audience did too. And thank you all for watching.
We tried to tell you earlier we have a dance party. I think we're gonna head into that here. So she's a classic friend on Broadway. She can tell shop.
Oh, we got the SAG move.
Yeah. All right. See you guys.
Have a great weekend.
Bye.